A History of Unauthorized Innovation. For most colonial officials and their successors, high modernist commitments led them to form inaccurate assumptions about indigenous agriculture and blinded them to its dynamism. Far from being timeless, static, and rigid, indigenous agricultural practices were constantly being revised and adapted. Some of this plasticity was part of a broad repertoire of techniques that could be adjusted, for example, to different patterns of rainfall, soils, pitches of land, market opportunities, and labor supplies. Most African cultivators were typically utilizing more than one cultivation technique during a season, and knew many more that might come in handy. When entirely novel cultivars from the New World became available, they were adopted with alacrity where appropriate. Thus, maize, cassava, potatoes, chilies, and a variety of New World pulses and gourds were incorporated into many African planting regimens. The history of on-farm experimentation, selection, and adaptation was, of course, a very old story indeed, both in Africa and elsewhere. Ethnobotany and paleobotany have been able to trace in some historical detail how hybrids and variants of, for example, the main Old World grains or New World maize were selected and propagated for a host of different uses and growing conditions. The same observation holds true for those plants that are vegetatively propagated, that is, propagated by cuttings rather than by seeds. On a strictly dispassionate view, more specialists would have concluded that there were many grounds for considering every African farm as something of a small-scale experimental station. It stands to reason that any community of cultivators who must wrest their living from a stingy and variable environment will rarely overlook the opportunity to improve their security and food supply. The limits to local knowledge must also be emphasized. Indigenous cultivators knew their own environment and its possibilities remarkably well. But they, of course, lacked the knowledge that such tools of modern science as the microscope, aerial photography, and scientific plant breeding could provide. They often lacked, as did many cultivators elsewhere, the technology or the access to technology that make, say, large-scale irrigation schemes and highly mechanized agriculture possible. Like peasants in the Mediterranean basin, China, and India, they were capable of damaging their ecosystem, even if low population densities had thus far spared them from making this mistake. But if most agricultural specialists had appreciated how much the indigenous farmer did know, had appreciated her practical, experimental temper and willingness to adopt new crops and techniques when they met local needs, such specialists would have concluded, with Robert Chambers, that indigenous agricultural knowledge, despite being ignored or overridden by consultant experts, is the single largest knowledge resource not yet mobilized in the development enterprise. The institutional affinities of high modernist agriculture. The willful disdain for local competence shown by most agricultural specialists was not, I believe, simply a case of prejudice, of the educated urban and westernized elite toward the peasantry, or of the aesthetic commitments implicit in high modernism. Rather, official attitudes were also a matter of institutional privilege. To the degree that the cultivators' practices were presumed reasonable until proven otherwise, to the degree that specialists might learn as much from the farmer as vice versa, and to the degree that specialists had to negotiate with farmers as political equals, would the basic premise behind the official's institutional status and power be undermined? The unspoken logic behind most of the state projects of agricultural modernization was one of consolidating the power of central institutions and diminishing the autonomy of cultivators and their communities vis-à-vis those institutions. Every new material practice altered in some way the existing distribution of power, wealth, and status, and the agricultural specialists claimed to be neutral technicians with no institutional stake in the outcome can hardly be accepted at face value. The centralizing effects of Soviet collectivism and Ujamaa villages were perfectly obvious. So are those of large irrigation projects, where authorities decide when to release the water, how to distribute it, and what water fees to charge, or of agricultural plantations, where the workforce is supervised as if it were in a factory setting. For colonialized farmers, the effect of such centralization and expertise was a radical de-skilling of the cultivators themselves. Even in the context of family farms and a liberal economy, this was in fact the utopian prospect held up by Liberty Hyde Bailey, a plant breeder, apostle of agricultural science, and the chairman of the Country Life Commission under Theodore Roosevelt. Bailey declared, "There will be established in the open country plant doctors, plant breeders, soil experts, health experts, pruning and spraying experts, forest experts, recreation experts, market experts, and housekeeping experts, all of whom are needed for the purpose of giving special advice and direction." Bailey's future was one organized almost entirely by a managerial elite. Yet we are not to think of society as founded wholly on small separate tracts, of family farms occupied by persons who live merely in contentment. This would mean that all landsmen would be essentially laborers. We need to hold on the land many persons who possess large powers of organization, who are managers, who can handle affairs in a bold way. It would be fatal to the best social and spiritual results if such persons could find no adequate opportunities on the land and were forced into other occupations. In spite of these hopeful pronouncements and intentions, if one examines carefully many of the agricultural innovations of the 20th century, innovations that seemed purely technical and hence neutral, one cannot but conclude that many of them created commercial and political monopolies that inevitably diminished the autonomy of the farmer. The revolution in hybrid seeds, particularly corn, had this effect. Since hybrids are either sterile or do not breed true, the seed company that has bred the parents of the hybrid cross has valuable property in hybrid seed which it can sell every year, unlike the open-pollinated varieties which the farmer can select himself. A similar but not identical centralizing logic applied to the high-yielding varieties, HYVS, of wheat, rice, and maize developed over the past 30 years. Their enormous impact on yields, an impact that varied widely by crop and growing conditions, depended on combining a massive response to nitrogen application with short, tough stalks that prevented lodging. Realizing their potential yield required abundant water, usually via irrigation, large applications of commercial fertilizer, and the periodic application of pesticides. Mechanization of field preparation and harvesting was also promoted. As with hybrids, the lack of biological diversity in the fields meant that each generation of HYVS was likely to succumb to infestations of fungus, rust, or insects, necessitating the purchase of new seeds and new pesticides, as the insects built up resistance. The resulting biological arms race, which plant breeders and chemists believed that they can continue to win, is one that puts the cultivator increasingly in the hands of public and private specialists. As with the truly democratic aspects of Nyerere's policies, those elements of research and policy that might threaten the position of a managerial elite tended either not to be explored at all, or, if explored, to be selected against in policy implementation. The simplifying assumptions of agricultural science. This attempt at total control is an invitation to disorder, and the rule seems to be that the more rigid and exclusive is the specialist's boundary, and the stricter the control within it, the more disorder rages around it. One can take a greenhouse and grow summer vegetables in the wintertime, but in doing so, one creates a vulnerability to the weather and to the possibility of failure where none existed before. The control by which a tomato plant lives through January is much more problematic than the natural order by which an oak tree or a titmouse lives through January. Wendell Berry, The Unsettling of America. Most of the elements of state development programs have not been merely the whims of powerful elites. Even villagization in Tanzania had long been the subject of apparently sound agroeconomic analysis. Schemes for the introduction of such new crops as cotton, tobacco, groundnuts, and rice, as well as plans for mechanization, irrigation, and fertilizer regimens, had been preceded by lengthy technical studies and field trials. Why, then, have such a large number of these schemes failed to deliver anything like the results foreseen for them? A closely related question, which we will address in the next chapter, is why so many successful changes in agricultural practices and production have been pioneered not by the state, but by the autonomous initiative of cultivators themselves. The isolation of experimental variables. The record shows, it seems to me, that a substantial part of the problem lies in the systematic and necessary limitations of scientific work whenever the ultimate purpose of that work is practical adoption by a diverse set of practitioners working in a large variety of conditions. That is, some of the problems lie deeper than the institutional temptations to central control, the pathologies of administration, or the penchant for aesthetically satisfying but uneconomic show projects. Even under the best of circumstances, the laboratory results and the data from the experimental plots of research stations are a long country mile from the human and natural environments where they must ultimately find a home. The normal procedure in scientific agricultural research has historically been to focus almost exclusively on crop-by-crop experiments designed to test the impact of variations in inputs on yields. More recently, other variables have come under scrutiny. Thus, experiments might test yields under different soil and moisture conditions, or determine which hybrids resisted lodging or ripened in a way that facilitated machine harvesting. Ecologically conscious research has often proceeded in the same fashion. By isolating one by one the variables that might contribute, say, to biological resistance of a certain variety of fruit to a particular pest. The isolation of a very few variables, ideally just two, while controlling all others, is a key tenet of experimental science. As a procedure, it is both valuable and necessary to scientific work. Only by radically simplifying the experimental situation is it possible to guarantee unambiguous, verifiable, impersonal, and universal results. As a pioneer in chaos theory has put it, there is a fundamental presumption in physics that the way you understand the world is that you keep isolating its ingredients until you understand the stuff you think is truly fundamental. Then you presume that the other things you don't understand are details. The assumption is that there are a small number of principles that you can discern by looking at things in their pure state. This is the truly analytic notion. And somehow, you put these together in some more complicated ways when you want to solve more dirty problems. If you can. In agricultural research, controlling for all possible variables except those under experimental scrutiny required normalizing assumptions about such things as weather, soils, and landscapes, not to mention normalizing assumptions often implicit about farm size, labor availability, and the desires of cultivators. Test tube research, of course, most closely approximated the ideal of controls. Even the experimental plot on a research station, however, was itself a radical simplification. It maximized the degree of control within a small and highly simplified enclosure, and ignored the rest, leaving it totally out of control. It is easy to see how monoculture and attention to quantitative yields would fit most comfortably within this paradigm. Monoculture eliminates all other cultivars that might complicate the design, while concern with quantitative yields avoids the thorny measurement problems that would arise if a particular quality or taste were the objective. The science of forestry is easiest when one is interested only in the commercial wood from a single species of tree. The science of agriculture is easiest when it is a question of the most efficient way of getting as many bushels as possible of one hybrid of maize from a normalized acre. A progressive loss of experimental control occurs when one moves from the laboratory to the research plot on an experimental station, and then to field trials on actual farms. Richards notes the unease such a move aroused among researchers in West Africa, who were anxious about making their research more practical, yet concerned about any relaxing of experimental conditions. After discussing how the farms selected for trials ought to be relatively homogeneous so that they would respond in uniform ways to the experimental results, the researchers went on to lament the experimental control that they lost by leaving the research station. "It may be difficult," they wrote, "to plant at all locations within a few days, and almost impossible to find farm plots of uniform soil." They continued, Other types of interference, such as pest attacks or bad weather, may affect some treatments and not others. This is, Richards explains, a salutary reminder of one of the reasons why formal scientific research procedures on experimental stations, with the stress on controlling all variables except the one or two under direct investigation, miss the point as far as many smallholders are concerned. The main concern of farmers is how to cope with these complex interactions and unscheduled events. From the scientists' point of view, particularly in relation to the need to secure clear-cut results for publication, on-farm experimentation poses a tough challenge. To the extent that science is obliged to deal simultaneously with the complex interactions of many variables, it begins to lose the very characteristics that distinguish it as modern science. Nor does the accumulation of many narrow experimental studies add up to the same thing as a single study of such complexity. This is not, I must repeat, a case against the experimental techniques of modern scientific research. Any extensive on-farm research study that did not reduce the complexity of interactions might be able to show, as farmers can, that a set of practices produced good results, say, high yields. But it would not be able to isolate the key factors responsible for this result. The case that I am making instead recognizes the power and utility of scientific work within its domain and recognizes its limitations in dealing with the kinds of problems for which its techniques are ill-suited. Blind spots. Returning once again to the case of polyculture, we can see why agronomists might have scientific as well as aesthetic and institutional grounds for opposing polycropping. Complex forms of intercropping introduce too many variables into simultaneous play to offer much chance of unambiguous experimental proof of causal relations. We know that certain polycultural techniques, particularly those combining nitrogen-fixing legumes with grains, are quite productive, but we know little about the precise interactions that bring about these results. And we find problems in teasing out causation even when we confine our attention to the single dependent variable of quantitative yields. If we relax this restriction of focus and begin to consider a wider range of dependent variables, outcomes, such as soil fertility, interactions with livestock, fodder, manuring, compatibility with family labor supply, and so on, the difficulties of comparison rapidly become intractable to scientific method. The nature of the scientific problem here is strongly analogous to that of complexity in physical systems. The elegantly simple formulas of Newton's laws of mechanics make it relatively easy to calculate the orbits of two heavenly bodies once we know their respective masses and the distance between them. Add one more body, however, and the calculation of orbits resulting from the interaction becomes far more complex. When there are 10 bodies interacting, this is the simplified version of our solar system, no orbits ever exactly repeat themselves, and there is no way to predict the long-term state of the system. As each new variable is introduced, the number of ramifying interactions to be taken into account grows geometrically. It does not stretch the facts too far, I think, to claim that scientific agricultural research has an elective affinity with agricultural techniques that lie within reach of its powerful methods. Maximizing the yields of pure-stand crops is one technique where its power can be used to best advantage. Insofar as its institutional power has permitted, agricultural agencies, like scientific foresters, have tended to simplify their environments in ways that make them more amenable to their system of knowledge. The forms of agriculture that conform to their modernist aesthetic and their politico-administrative interests also happen to fit securely within the perimeter of their professional scientific vocation. What of the disorder outside the realm of the experimental design? Extra-experimental interactions can in fact prove beneficial when they strengthen the desired effect. There is no a priori reason for anticipating what their effects might be. What is significant is that they lie wholly outside the experimental model. Occasionally, however, these effects have been both important and potentially threatening. A striking example from the years between 1947 and 1960 was the massive worldwide use of pesticides, the most infamous of which was DDT. DDT was sprayed to kill mosquito populations and thereby reduce the many diseases that the pests carry. The experimental model was largely confined to determining the dosage concentrations and application conditions required for eradicating mosquito populations. Within its field of vision, the model was successful. DDT did kill mosquitoes and dramatically reduced the incidence of endemic malaria and other diseases. It also had, as we slowly became aware, devastating ecological effects, as residues were absorbed by organisms all along the food chain, of which humans are, of course, also a part. The consequences of the use of DDT and other pesticides on soil, water, fish, insects, birds, and fauna were so intricate that we have not yet gotten to the bottom of them. Weak peripheral vision. Part of the problem was that the side effects were constantly ramifying. A first-order effect, say the decline or disappearance of a local insect population, led to changes in flowering plants, which changed the habitat for other plants and for rodents, and so on. Another part of the problem was that the effects of pesticides on other species were examined only under experimental conditions, yet the application of DDT was under field conditions. And as Carson pointed out, scientists had no idea what the interactive effects of pesticides were when they were mixed with water and soil and acted upon by sunlight. That awareness of these interaction effects came from outside the scientific paradigm itself is both interesting and, I think, diagnostic. It began, in particular, when people gradually came to realize that the songbird population had suffered a radical decline. Public alarm at what was not happening anymore outside their kitchen windows led, eventually, through scientific research, to a tracing of how DDT concentrations in the organs of birds led to fragile eggshells and reproductive failure. This finding, in turn, stimulated a host of related inquiries into the effects of pesticides, and ultimately to legislation banning the use of DDT. In this case, as in others, the power of the scientific paradigm was achieved partly by its exclusion of extra-experimental variables that have often circled back, as it were, to take their revenge. The logic of agroeconomic analysis of farming efficiency and profits also wins its power by a comparable restriction of the field of focus. Its tools are used to best advantage in examining the microeconomics of the farm as a firm. On the basis of its necessary simplifying assumptions about factor costs, inputs, weather, labor use, and prices, it can show how profitable or unprofitable it might be to use a particular piece of machinery, to buy irrigation equipment, or to raise one crop rather than another. Studies of this kind, and also of marketing, have tended to demonstrate the economies of scale achievable by large, highly capitalized, and highly mechanized operations. Outside this narrow perspective are hundreds of considerations that are necessarily bracketed in a manner similar to that used in experimental science. But here, in agroeconomic analysis, the human agents adopting this view have the political capacity, in the short run at least, to make certain that they are not held economically responsible for the larger, extra-firm consequences of their logic. The pattern in agriculture in the United States was clearly outlined by a rogue economist testifying to Congress in 1972. Only in the past decade has serious attention been given to the fact that the large agricultural firm is able to achieve benefits by externalizing certain costs. The disadvantages of large-scale operation fall largely outside the decision-making framework of the large farm firm. Problems of waste disposal, pollution control, added burdens on public service, deterioration of rural social structures, impairment of the tax base, and the political consequences of a concentration of economic power have typically not been considered as costs of large scale by the firm. They are unquestionably costs to the larger community. In theory, large-scale operation should enable the firm to bring a wide range of both costs and benefits within its internal decision-making framework. In practice, the economic and political power that accompanies large scale provides constant temptation to the large firm to take the benefits and pass on the costs. In other words, although the business analysts of the agricultural firms have weak peripheral vision, the political clout that such firms possess, both individually and collectively, can help them avoid being blindsided. Short-sightedness. Nearly all studies purporting to evaluate decisions of interest to farmers are experiments that last one or at most a few seasons. Implicitly, the logic behind a research design of this kind is that the long-run effects will not contradict the short-run findings. The question of the time horizon of research is directly relevant even to those for whom the maximization of yields is the holy grail. Unless they are exclusively interested in immediate yields, no matter what the consequences, their attention must be directed to the issue of sustainability or to Hicksian income. Perhaps the most significant practical division is thus not between those who would design agricultural policy with cultural and social goals in mind, such as the preservation of the family farm, the landscape, or diversity, and those who want to maximize production and profit, but rather between productionists with a short view and productionists with a long view. After all, concern about soil erosion and water supply was motivated less often by regard for the environment than by regard for the sustainability of current production. The relatively short-run orientation of crop studies and farm economics works to exclude even those long-run results of interest to the productionists. Many of the claims for polyculture, for example, assert its superiority over the long haul as a system of production. A polycropping trial of 20 or more years, as Stephen Marglin has suggested, might well reach conclusions that are quite different from those derived from a trial that lasts a season or two. It is not at all implausible that the process of open pollination and selection by farmers, as opposed to hybridization, might have developed cultivars roughly equal in yield to the best hybrids and superior to them in many other respects, including profitability. The paper profits of scientific monocropped forests, we now realize, were achieved at considerable cost to the long-term health and productivity of the forest. One would have supposed that since most farms are family enterprises, there would have been more studies of cropping and firm economics that took as their analytical unit of time the entire family cycle of one generation. Nothing in the logic of the scientific method itself seems to require that a short-run perspective prevail. Rather, such a perspective seems to be a response to institutional and perhaps commercial pressures. On the other hand, the need to isolate a few variables while assuming everything else constant, and the bracketing of interaction effects that lie outside the experimental model are very definitely inscribed in scientific method. They are a condition of the formidable clarity it achieves within its field of vision. Taken together, the parts of the landscape occluded by actual scientific practice, the blind spots, the periphery, and the long view, also constitute a formidable portion of the real world. The simplifying practice of scientific agriculture. Some yields are more equal than others. Modern agricultural research commonly proceeds as if yields, per unit of scarce inputs, were the central concern of the farmer. The assumption is enormously convenient. Like the commercial wood of scientific forestry, the generic homologous uniform commodities thus derived create the possibility both of quantitative comparisons between the yield of different cultivation techniques and of aggregate statistics. The familiar tabulations of acres planted, yields per acre, and total production from year to year are usually the decisive measure of success in a development program. But the premise that all rice, all corn, and all millet are equal, however useful, is simply not a plausible assumption about any crop unless it is purely a commodity for sale in the market. Each subspecies of grain has distinctive properties, not just in how it grows, but in its qualities as a grain once harvested. In some cultures, certain varieties of rice are grown for use in certain distinctive dishes. Other varieties of rice may be used only for specific ritual purposes or in the settlement of local debts. Some of the complex considerations that go into distinguishing one rice from another in terms of their cooking properties alone can be appreciated from Richards's observations about how the considerations are weighed in Sierra Leone. A phrase like, "it cooks badly," is often a catch-all for a range of properties connected with storage, preparation, and consumption, going well beyond subjective questions of taste. Is the variety concerned well adapted to local food processing techniques? Is it readily peeled, milled, and pounded? How much water and fuel does it require in cooking? How long does it keep prior to cooking and once cooked? Mende women claim that improved swamp rices are much less palatable than the harder upland rices when served up a second time. With the right kind of rice, it is possible to cut down the number of times it is necessary to cook during busy periods on the farm. Since cooking sometimes takes up to 3 to 4 hours per day, including the time taken to husk rice, prepare a fire, and collect water, this is a factor of no small importance when labor is short. So far, we have considered only the husked grain. What if we broaden our view to take in the rest of the plant? At once, we see that there is a great deal more to be harvested from a plant than its seed grains. Thus, a Central American peasant may not be interested only in the number and size of the corn kernels she harvested. She may also be interested in using the cobs for fodder and scrub brushes, the husk and leaves for wrappers, thatch, and fodder, and the stalks as trellises for climbing beans, as fodder, and as temporary fencing. The fact that Central American farmers know of many more maize varieties than do their counterparts in the Corn Belt of the United States is partly related to the uses to which different varieties are put. Maize may also be sold in the market for any of these purposes, and thus prized for qualities other than its kernels. The same story could, of course, be told about virtually any widely grown cultivar. Its various parts, from various stages of growth, may come in handy as twine, vegetable dyes, medicinal poultices, greens to eat raw or to cook, packaging material, bedding, or items for ritual or decorative purposes. Even from a commercial point of view, then, the plant is not simply its grain. Nor are all grains of all subspecies and hybrids of maize and rice equal. The yield of seeds by weight or volume may therefore be only one of many ends, and perhaps not the most important one for a cultivator. But once scientific agriculture or plant breeding begins to introduce this enormous range of value and uses into its own calculations, it is once again in the Newtonian dilemma of the 10 heavenly bodies. And even if it were able to represent some of this complexity in its models, these usages are subject to change without notice. Experimental plots versus actual fields. All environments, as we noted earlier, are intractably local. There is always what we call the translation problem in converting the generic standardized High Church Latin, which emanates from labs and experimental stations, into the vernacular of the local parish. Standardized solutions to field preparation, planting schedules, and fertilizer requirements always have to be adjusted when they are applied to, say, a stony, low-lying, north-facing field, which has just grown 2 crops of oats. Agricultural scientists at research stations and extension agents are very much aware of this translation problem, as are specialists in any applied science. The question is always how to discover and convey findings so that they will be helpful to farmers. As long as the findings or solutions are not simply imposed, the farmer must decide if they meet his needs. Like cadastral maps, the experimental plots of agricultural research stations cannot begin to represent the diversity and variability of farmers' fields. The researchers must operate on the basis of standard, normal range assumptions about soil, field preparation, weeding, rainfall, temperature, and so on, whereas each farmer's field is a unique concatenation of circumstances, actions, and events, some of which are knowable in advance, soil composition, and some of which are out of anyone's hands, the weather. The interactions among these and other variables are at least as important as the status of each. Thus, the effects of an early monsoon on rocky soil that has just been weeded are different from those of an early monsoon on waterlogged land that has not been weeded. The averages and normalizations of experimental work obscure the fact that an average weather year or a standard soil is a statistical fiction. As Wendell Berry puts it, "The industrial version of agriculture has it that farming brings the farmer annually over and over again to the same series of problems, to each one of which there is always the same generalized solution, and therefore that industry's solution can be simply and safely substituted for his solution." But that is false. On a good farm, because of weather and other so-called variables, neither the annual series of problems nor any of the problems individually is ever quite the same 2 years running. The good farmer, like the artist, the quarterback, the statesman, must be master of many possible solutions, one of which he must choose under pressure and apply with skill in the right place at the right time. Soil, although it is not as capriciously variable day by day as the weather, is often exceptionally variable within the same field. The essential simplifications of agricultural science require, first, that soil be sorted into a small number of categories based on acidity, nitrogen levels, and other qualities. For analyzing the soil of a single field, the practice is to gather bits of soil from several parts of the field and to combine them in the sample to be analyzed so that it will represent an average. This procedure implicitly recognizes the substantial variation in soil quality over a given field. The recommended fertilizer application may therefore not be right for any part of the field, but compared to applications derived from other formulas, it will be less wrong, on average, for the field as a whole. Once again, Berry cautions us against these generalizations. Most farms, even most fields, are made up of different kinds of soil patterns and soil scents. Good farmers have always known this and have used the land accordingly. They have been careful students of the natural vegetation, soil depth and structure, slope and drainage. They are not appliers of generalizations, theoretical or methodological or mechanical. When to the complexity and variation of the soil conditions we add the practice of polyculture, the obstacles to a successful application of a general formula become virtually insurmountable. The knowledge we do have of the limits on some plants' tolerance of temperature and moisture does not ensure that they will necessarily thrive within these limits. The typical plant is awfully finicky about just where and when it will grow, under exactly what conditions it will germinate, as Edgar Anderson explains. The vastly more intricate business of which plants they will and will not tolerate as neighbors, and under what conditions, has never been looked into except in a preliminary way for a few species. Indigenous farmers are exceptionally alert to microfeatures of terrain and environment that are important to cultivation. Two examples from Richards's analysis of West Africa will serve to illustrate the small details that are simply too minute to be visible within a standardizing grid. Among the bewildering variety of small-scale local irrigation practices, Richards classifies at least 11 different kinds, some with sub-variations. All depend directly on locally specific details of topography, soil, flooding, rainfall, and so on, with the type of irrigation used depending on whether the area is a seasonally flooded delta, saucer-shaped depression with poor drainage, or an inland valley swamp. These small schemes, which take advantage of the existing possibilities of the landscape, are a far cry from vast engineered schemes in which no effort is spared to modify the landscape in conformity with the engineering plan. Richards's second example shows how West African farmers used a rather simple but ingenious choice in what strain of rice to plant to help them cope with a local pest. Mende farmers on one area of Sierra Leone had, against the textbook advice on the varieties of rice to be preferred, selected a variant of rice with long awns, beard or bristles, and glooms, bracts. The textbook reasoning was probably that such varieties were lower yielding or that the awns and glooms would simply add more chaff that would have to be winnowed after threshing. The farmer's reasoning was that the long awns and glooms discouraged birds from eating the bulk of their rice before it ever made it to the threshing floor. These details about micro-irrigation and the damage caused by birds are vital for local cultivators, but such details do not and cannot appear on the high-flying mapping of modern agricultural planning. Many critics of scientific agriculture have claimed not only that it has systematically favored large-scale production-oriented monoculture, but that its research findings are of at best limited use since all agriculture is local. Howard argued for a fundamentally different practice, basing it on two premises. The first was that experimental plots could not yield helpful results. Small plots and farms are very different things. It is impossible to manage a small plot as a self-contained unit in the same way as a good farm is conducted. The essential relation between livestock and the land is lost. There are no means of maintaining the fertility of the soil by suitable rotations, as is the rule in good farming. The plot and the farm are obviously out of relation. The plot does not even represent the field in which it occurs. A collection of field plots cannot represent the agricultural problem they set out to investigate. What possible advantage, therefore, can be obtained by the application of higher mathematics to a technique which is so fundamentally unsound? Howard's second premise is that many of the most important indications of a farm and a crop's health are qualitative. Can a mutually interacting system, like the crop and the soil, for example, dependent on a multitude of factors which are changing from week to week and year to year, ever be made to yield quantitative results corresponding to the precision of mathematics? As Howard sees it, the danger is that the narrow, experimental, and exclusively quantitative approach will succeed in completely driving out the other forms of local knowledge and judgment possessed by most cultivators. But Howard and others, it seems to me, miss the most important abstraction of experimental work in scientific agriculture. How can we define how useful this research is until we know the ends to which cultivators will put it? Useful for what? It is at the level of human agency where scientific agriculture constructs its greatest abstraction, the creation of a stock character, the everyman cultivator, who is interested only in realizing the greatest yields at the least cost. Fictional farmers versus real farmers. Not only are the weather, the crops, and the soil complex and variable, the farmer is too. Season by season, and frequently day by day, millions of cultivators are pursuing an innumerable variety of complicated goals. These goals and the shifting mix between them defy any simple model or description. Profitable production of one or more major crops, the usual standard of agricultural research, is obviously one purpose shared by most cultivators. It is instructive, nevertheless, to observe how deeply mediated this goal is by other purposes that may indeed usurp it altogether. The complexities I suggest below merely scratch the surface. Each farm family has its unique endowment of land, skills, tools, and labor which greatly constrain how it farms. Consider only one aspect of labor supply. A labor-rich farm with many able-bodied young workers has options in growing labor-intensive crops, in planting schedules, and in developing artisan sidelines that are not easily available to labor-poor farms. Furthermore, the same family farm will go through several stages in the course of a family cycle of development. Farmers who migrate out for wage work during part of the year may plant crops of early or late maturity, or crops requiring little care, in order to accommodate their migratory schedule. As we saw earlier, a particular crop's profit may be tied to more than just its yield in grain and the cost of producing it. The stubble of a crop may be crucial as fodder for livestock or waterfowl. A crop may be vital because of what it does to the soil in rotation with other crops, or how it assists another crop with which it is interplanted. A crop may be less important for its grain than for what it supplies, in raw material, for artisanal production, whether that material is sold in the market or used at home. Families who live close to the subsistence line may choose their crops not on the basis of their profitability, but on the basis of how steady their yields are, and whether they can be eaten if their market price plunges. The complexities thus far introduced could, at least in principle, be accommodated within a drastically modified neoclassical notion of economic maximization, even though it would be too elaborate to model easily. Once we add such considerations as aesthetics, rituals, taste, and social and political considerations, this is no longer the case. There are any number of perfectly rational but non-economic reasons for wanting to grow a certain crop in a certain way, whether because one wishes to maintain cooperative relations with neighbors or because a particular crop is linked to group identity. Such cultural habits are perfectly compatible with commercial success, as the experience of the Amish, Mennonites, and Hutterites demonstrates. As long as we are pointing to the high level of abstraction of the farm family for whom scientific agricultural research does its work, we should note that, in much of the world, an understanding of the practices in use on almost any farm will require distinguishing the purposes of the various members of the family. Each family enterprise is, on closer inspection, a partnership, albeit typically unequal, with its own internal politics. The units of farmer and farm community are, finally, every bit as intricate and fluid as the weather, soil, and landscape. Mapping them is even more problematic than, say, analyzing the soil. The reason, I think, is that while the farmer's expertise may occasionally fail him in assessing his own soil, we will not doubt the farmer's expertise in knowing his own mind and interests. Just as the buzzing complexity and plasticity of customary land tenure practices cannot be satisfactorily represented in the straitjacket of modern freehold property law, so the complex motives and goals of cultivators in the land they farm cannot be effectively portrayed by the standardizations of scientific agriculture. The schematic representations, so important for experimental work, can and have produced important new knowledge, which, suitably adapted, has been incorporated into most agricultural routines. With such abstractions, again like those of freehold tenure, are powerful misrepresentations that usually circle back to influence reality. They operate, at a minimum, to generate research and findings most applicable to farms that meet the description of their schematization: large, monocropped, mechanized, commercial farms, producing solely for the market. In addition, this standardization is typically linked to public policy in the form of tax incentives, loans, price supports, marketing subsidies, and, significantly, handicaps imposed on enterprises that do not fit the schematization, which systematically operate to nudge reality toward the grid of its observations. The effect is nothing like the shock therapy of the campaigns for Soviet collectivization or Ujamaa villages, which relied more on sticks than carrots. But over the long haul, such a powerful grid can and does change the landscape. Two agricultural logics compared. If the logic of actual farming is one of an inventive, practiced response to a highly variable environment, the logic of scientific agriculture is, by contrast, one of adapting the environment as much as possible to its centralizing and standardizing formulas. Thanks to the pioneering work of Jan Dalva van der Ploeg, it is possible to spell out how this logic works for potato cultivation in the Andes. Van der Ploeg calls indigenous potato cultivation in the Andes a craft. The cultivator begins with an exceptionally diverse local ecology and aims at both successfully adapting to it and gradually improving it. Andean farmers' skills have allowed them to achieve results that are quite respectable in terms of narrow productionist goals, and extraordinarily so in terms of reliability of yields and sustainability. The typical farmer cultivates anywhere from 12 to 15 distinct parcels, as well as other plots, on a rotating basis. Given the great variety of conditions on each plot, altitude, soil, history of cultivation, slope, orientation to wind and sun, each field is unique. The very idea of a standard field in this context is an empty abstraction. Some fields contain only one cultivar, others between 2 and 10. Sometimes interplanted in the same row or with each in its own row. Each cultivar is a well-placed bet in its niche. The variety of cultivars makes for local experimentation with new crosses and hybrids, each of which is tested and exchanged among farmers, and the many land races of potatoes thus developed have unique characteristics that become well known. From the appearance of a new variety to its substantial use in the fields takes at least 5 or 6 years. Each season is the occasion for a new round of prudent bets, with last season's results in terms of yield, disease, prices, and response to changed plot conditions having been carefully weighed. These farms are market-oriented experiment stations with good yields, great adaptability, and reliability. Perhaps more important, they are not just producing crops. They are reproducing farmers and communities with plant breeding skills, flexible strategies, ecological knowledge, and considerable self-confidence and autonomy. Compare this craft-based potato production with the inherent logic of scientific agriculture. The process begins with the definition of an ideal plant type. Ideal is defined mainly, but not only, in terms of yields. Professional plant breeders then begin synthesizing the strains that might combine to form a new genotype with the desired characteristics. Then, and only then, are the plant strains grown in experimental plots in order to determine the conditions under which the potential of the new genotype will be realized. The basic procedure is exactly the reverse of Andean craft production, where the cultivator begins with the plot, its soil, and its ecology, and then selects or develops varieties that will likely thrive in this setting. The variety of cultivars in such a community is in large part a reflection of the variety of both local needs and ecological conditions. In scientific potato growing, by contrast, the point of departure is the new cultivar or genotype, in service of which every effort is made to transform and homogenize field conditions so that the field meets the genotype's specific requirements. The logic of beginning with an ideal genotype and then transforming nature to accord with its growing conditions has some predictable consequences. Extension work essentially becomes the attempt to remake the farmer's field to suit the genotype. This usually requires the application of nitrogen fertilizer and pesticides, which must be purchased and applied at the right moment. It usually also requires a watering regimen that in many cases only irrigation can possibly satisfy. The timing of all operations for this genotype, planting, cultivating, fertilizer spreading, and so forth, are spelled out carefully. The logic of the process, a logic not even remotely realized on the ground, is to transform the farmers into standard farmers growing the required genotype on similar soils and leveled fields, and according to the instructions printed right on the seed packages, applying the same fertilizers, pesticides, and amounts of water. It is a logic of homogenization and the virtual elimination of local knowledge. To the degree that this homogenization is successful, the genotype will likely succeed in terms of production levels in the short run. Conversely, to the degree that such homogenization is impossible, the genotype will fail. Once the job of the agricultural specialist is defined as one of raising all farmers' plots to the uniform condition that will realize the new cultivar's promise, there is no further need to attend to the great variety of conditions, some of which are unalterable, on actual farmers' fields. Rather than have the facts on the ground muddy a simple unitary research issue, it was more convenient to try to impose a research abstraction on the fields and lives of farmers. Given the intractable ecological variety of the Andes, this was a nearly fatal step. Rarely have agricultural specialists asked themselves, as did the Russian S.P. Fridalin well before the revolution, whether they might not be working from the wrong angle. He realized that his work was actually harming the peasants. Instead of learning what local conditions were and then making agricultural practice fit these conditions better, he had been trying to improve local practice so that it would conform to abstract standards. It is little wonder that scientific agriculture tends to favor the creation of large artificial practices and environments, irrigation schemes, large and leveled fields, the application of fertilizer by formula, greenhouses, pesticides, all of which allow a homogenization and control of nature within which ideal experimental conditions for its genotypes can be maintained. There is, I think, a larger lesson here. An explicit set of rules will take you further when the situation is cut and dried. The more static and one-dimensional the stereotype, the less the need for creative interpretation and adaptation. In the Andes, Van der Ploeg implies the rules attached to the new potato were so restrictive that they could never be successfully translated to the great variety of local farming vernaculars. One of the major purposes of state simplifications, collectivization, assembly lines, plantations, and planned communities alike is to strip down reality to the bare bones so that the rules will in fact explain more of the situation and provide a better guide to behavior. To the extent that this simplification can be imposed, those who make the rules can actually supply crucial guidance and instruction. This, at any rate, is what I take to be the inner logic of social, economic, and productive de-skilling. If the environment can be simplified down to the point where the rules do explain a great deal, those who formulate the rules and techniques have also greatly expanded their power. They have correspondingly diminished the power of those who do not. To the degree that they do succeed, cultivators with a high degree of autonomy, skills, experience, self-confidence, and adaptability are replaced by cultivators following instructions. Such reduction in diversity, movement, and life, to recall Jacobs's term, represents a kind of social taxidermy. The new potato genotype, as Van der Ploeg shows, usually fails, if not immediately, within 3 or 4 years. Unlike the ensemble of indigenous varieties, the new cultivar thrives within a narrower band of environmental conditions. Many things, in other words, must go right for the new cultivar to produce well, and if any of these things goes wrong, too much hot weather, late delivery of fertilizer, and so forth, the yields suffer dramatically. Within a few years, the new genotypes become incapable of generating even low levels of production. In practice, however, the vast majority of Andean cultivators are neither purely traditional cultivators nor mindless followers of the scientific specialists. They are instead crafting unique amalgams of strategies that reflect their aims, their resources, and their local conditions. Where the new potatoes seem to fit their purposes, they may plant some, but they may interplant them with other cultivars, and may substitute dung or plow in green manure, alfalfa, clover, rather than apply the standard fertilizer package. They are constantly inventing and experimenting with different rotations, timing, and weeding techniques. But because of the very particularity of these thousands of in-field experiments and the specialists' studied inattention to them, they are illegible, if not invisible, to scientific research. Farmers, being polytheists when it comes to agricultural practice, are quick to seize whatever seems useful from the epistemic work of formal science. But the researchers, trained as monotheists, seem all but incapable of absorbing the informal experimental results of practice. Conclusion. The great confidence that high modernist agriculture has inspired among its practitioners and partisans should not surprise us. It is associated with unparalleled agricultural productivity in the West and with the power and prestige of the scientific and industrial revolutions. Little wonder, then, that the tenets of high modernism, as talismans of the true faith, should have been carried throughout the world uncritically and indeed with the conviction that they lighted the way to agricultural progress. I believe that this uncritical and hence unscientific trust in the artifacts and techniques of what became codified as scientific agriculture was responsible for its failures. The logical companion to a complete faith in a quasi-industrial model of high modernist agriculture was an often explicit contempt for the practices of actual cultivators and what might be learned from them. Whereas a scientific spirit would have counseled skepticism and dispassionate inquiry into these practices, modern agriculture as a blind faith preached scorn and summary dismissal. Actual cultivators in West Africa and elsewhere should more accurately have been understood as lifelong experimenters conducting in-field seasonal trials, the results of which they incorporated into their ever-evolving repertoire of practices. Inasmuch as these experimenters were and are surrounded by hundreds or thousands of other local experimenters with whom they share research findings and the knowledge of generations of earlier research as codified in folk wisdom, they could be said to have instant access to the popular equivalent of an impressive research library. Now, it is also undeniably the case that they carry out most of their research without the proper experimental controls and are therefore prone to drawing false inferences from their findings. They are also limited by what they can observe. Microprocesses only visible in the laboratory necessarily escape them. Nor is it clear that the ecological logic that seems to work well on a single farm over the long haul will at the same time produce sustainable aggregate results for an entire region. That said, it is also the case, however, that West African cultivators have at their disposal a lifetime of careful local observation and the fine-grained knowledge of the locality that no research scientist can hope to duplicate for the same terrain. And let us not fail to note what kind of experimenters these are. Their lives and the lives of their families depend directly on the outcomes of their field experiments. Given these important positional advantages, one would have imagined that agricultural scientists would have paid attention to what these farmers did know. It was their failure to do so, Howard claims, that constitutes the great shortcoming of modern scientific agriculture. The approach to the problems of farming must be made from the field, not from the laboratory. The discovery of the things that matter is three-quarters of the battle. In this, the observant farmer and laborer, who have spent their lives in close contact with nature, can be of greatest help to the investigator. The views of the peasantry in all countries are worthy of respect. There is always good reason for their practices. In matters like the cultivation of mixed crops, they themselves are still the pioneers. Howard credits most of his own findings about soil, humus, and root action to a careful observation of indigenous farming practice, and he is rather disdainful of agricultural specialists who do not have to take their own advice, that is, who have never had to see their own crop through from planting to harvest. Why, then, the unscientific scorn for practical knowledge? There are at least three reasons for it, as far as I can tell. The first is the professional reason mentioned earlier. The more the cultivator knows, the less the importance of the specialist and his institutions. The second is the simple reflex of high modernism, namely, a contempt for history and past knowledge. As the scientist is always associated with the modern, and the indigenous cultivator with the past that modernism will banish, the scientist feels that he or she has little to learn from that quarter. The third reason is that practical knowledge is represented and codified in a form uncongenial to scientific agriculture. From a narrow scientific view, nothing is known until and unless it is proven in a tightly controlled experiment. Knowledge that arrives in any form other than through the techniques and instruments of formal scientific procedure does not deserve to be taken seriously. The imperial pretense of scientific modernism admits knowledge only if it arrives through the aperture that the experimental method has constructed for its admission. Traditional practices, codified as they are in practice and in folk sayings, are seen presumptively as not meriting attention, let alone verification. And yet, as we have seen, cultivators have devised and perfected a host of techniques that do work, producing desirable results in crop production, pest control, soil preservation, and so forth. By constantly observing the results of their field experiments and retaining those methods that succeed, the farmers have discovered and refined practices that work without knowing the precise chemical or physical reasons why they work. In agriculture, as in many other fields, practice has long preceded theory. And indeed, some of these practically successful techniques, which involve a large number of simultaneously interacting variables, may never be fully understood by the techniques of science. We turn, then, to a closer examination of practical knowledge, a kind of knowledge that high modernism has ignored to its peril.